Welcome to the Rehab Your Life podcast. I am your host, Karen Malone, and I am a certified rehabilitation counselor dedicated to helping you rehab your life. Each week, I will be interviewing people to talk about how they have overcome struggles, and I will also share valuable information about a topic that will help you to move forward in your journey. I will also share tools and resources and any nuggets that I have found along the way. I will be challenging you to change your perspective, because when you change your thinking, you can change your life. This episode is sponsored by my book, Lose to Win. It's all about my journey as a believer going through the hardest times of my life, the loss of my child, battling cancer twice, and much more. I share tangible tips on how I managed to keep my sanity through it all. It's available on Amazon.com. I hope that you pick up a copy today. Okay, so this week is a very special podcast episode. Mr. Will Wise was the person that I met that changed the whole trajectory of my life. That might sound heavy, but it really was a pivotal point in my life, having met him, to start the whole process of starting this podcast. And now, 2 years later, I am still doing the podcast. He and I met at a conference in Galveston, Texas. He's from the Pennsylvania area, and he had a booth, and we ended up, you know, talking, and I went to his training session. And just the way that he thinks and can engage people in conversation to ask the powerful question, it really just has intrigued me and has kept me intrigued for these last couple of years. And so to have him on the podcast has just been just lovely to me. You know, I call a friend, and even though, you know, it's just through social media and phone calls every now and again, we've both been able to be there for each other and keep each other encouraged through it all. And so he is a father, he is a husband, he is an author, a speaker, and a cancer survivor. And he is just one of those guys that you'll love him when you meet him. And so I take this privilege to have a little bit of his time to come onto the podcast. Very, very special to me. And so I want to introduce to you Mr. Will Wise of We and Me. Hey guys, thank you so much for returning to another episode of the Rehab Your Life podcast. Today, I'm so excited for my guest, Mr. Will Wise. Hey, Will, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Super excited to be here with you, Karen.
Awesome. Thank you so much for making time. In my intro, I did tell my audience a little bit about you, but I wanted for you to be able to talk a little bit more about the types of challenges that you've had to overcome over these last year or so.
What do I say to that?
I know.
Well, it's been a journey. So, in March of last year, so that was 2019, I went to the doctor. doctor because I had a little bulge below my belly, and it would sometimes show up and sometimes not show up, and I had no idea what it was. My doctor looked at it immediately and said, it's a hernia. I went to a specialist, and the specialist said, so I don't know how much your listeners know about hernias, but in this particular case, a part of my intestines was popping out through a hole that's not supposed to pop out into my stomach region. And I met with the specialist, and he said, well, we could do surgery, or we could wait. It's really up to you. And I had this really strong sense that I had to move quickly. And I did. And I had the hernia surgery. And about 10 days later, I was home, fully recovered, and was having 104.9 fever, chills, all over body shakes. I went to the ER, and they could not figure out what was going on. And so they did a scan, and when they did a scan up around my stomach, they found some fluid that made them scratch their head a little bit and go, what's this? And so then we did some more scans, and in that whole process we figured out that I had salmonella. And I am grateful for the hernia and for the salmonella because it caused them to investigate. And they sent this camera down my throat, and just after the esophagus turned right, they found a tumor. And then that began the process of saying, okay, he's either got stomach cancer or esophageal cancer. And that kind of put me on this journey that has been a very, I would say, difficult challenge. How do you say that, right? So now I don't have a stomach. So they completely removed the stomach, and they attached the esophagus to the intestines. And some people wonder, then, do I show up with a blender everywhere I go? That's not true. My blender currently is my mouth, and I chew my food. I should chew my food more. But I eat, and I go to the bathroom, and everything is kind of normal, except that there's missing the stomach. The things that are abnormal is, for every 100 people who have the surgery, everybody has a different result, and I've reached the end of my doctor's knowledge, and so I'm really having to navigate what I can eat and can't eat. So currently I am a sugar-free, wheat-free, dairy-free, meat-free. Would that make me a vegan? So we're pretty sugar-free vegan. I eat a lot of carrots. Half of me is a carrot. I'm eating carrots, peas, green beans. Looks like brown rice is now working. I figured out how to make some cookies without eggs that I really love. It's kind of a power bar and helped me gain weight. I lost 40 pounds in the whole process. So I'm in the process of stabilizing my weight, and that's going fairly well. And I eat a lot of small meals. So during this call, there'll be a time in which hopefully you're talking because I'll be munching on this in the background. So I eat a lot of small meals often.
Okay. So
I give you enough of the journey?
Yes, yes. So let me ask you this. When they found the cancer, what stage was it when they found it?
I don't know how many of your listeners are on this journey, but every time I went to the doctor, I went up a stage.
Oh, wow.
It's no big deal. This is stage one. Go back. More scan. More. Oh, stage two. Oh, stage three. We don't really want to say it, but maybe it's stage four. So the most accurate thing to say is that it, the tumor was through the stomach wall, and they removed 30 lymph nodes in and around that region. The surgeon wishes that he would have saw me before chemo, and he did not. So once I found out what was going on. I went to multiple different doctors, got lots of different opinions, and just hit the accelerator as fast as I could. And started chemo right away. Part of that, I found a different doctor who had a more advanced version of chemo, and I decided to go for that. So I did 4 rounds of chemo, surgery, 4 rounds of chemo. So I ended up seeing the surgeon after I had already started chemo. And he, you know, surgeons, right, they see their world through removal or adding, mostly removal. And what he wished he would have had is to see me before chemo. He would have cut open my stomach just a little bit and looked between the skin and the guts. There's this membrane called the perineum. I think I'm saying it right. The sac that kind of holds everything together. And he would look to see if there was any cancer cells on that sac. Fortunately for me, the chemo was very effective, and when they removed my stomach, there was no cancer in it. But the protocol was 4 chemo removal and then 4 more rounds of chemo. You know, and so when they say that, there's people like, well, why didn't you just, like, not do the surgery? And I think part of it was because it's, you know, a fairly aggressive cancer, there was this, let's hit the accelerator, do the best we can as fast as we can, and just get it out. And so, you know, in retrospect, I might have some doubts and questions and why did I do what I did when I did it and such. But the chemo shrank everything down, stomach got removed. And then we did 4 more rounds of chemo to make sure there wasn't any little guys floating around. In my particular case, so they have to completely remove the stomach when the cancer is on the top half of the stomach, because you got this little sphincter between your esophagus and your stomach that keeps the acid from coming up. And they felt like they had to remove above that to make sure they got all cells that had cancer in it. In my particular case, the pathologist, when he looked at the stomach, said there are some cells at the line in which he cut. Maybe there's a chance that there were some cells in my esophagus that had cancer in them. But we're confident that the chemo zapped all of those out. And yeah.
So one of the things that I talk to my clients about is having a really good interdisciplinary team. And it sounds like you were very active in your role as the patient, helping to steer your team with information and knowledge, so that way it was more of a group decision. Would that be the case?
I would say so. If there's one thing that I want to say about my medical experience is when I went to the first set of doctors, there was a woman who introduced herself as a nurse navigator, and I loved that title. I wanted to get out of my chair and just give her a hug just because she had that title. The honest truth was, other than the nurse navigator, my gut told me this was not the place to do the work. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was because of that particular doctor, prescription. I mean, so we went, drove an hour and a half to a big fancy place, very well known. My surgeon ended up being one of those people that have 10 to 12 people following him wherever he goes. I love being at teaching hospitals because I feel like when people are teaching, they're super sharp. And my twins were born in a teaching hospital, and there was lots of medical issues going on. And I loved the fact that the nurses could stand up and the students could stand up to the doctors and say, wait a minute, this, you just said this, but that doesn't seem quite right with what we see on the records. And so I loved that. And so I had a sense to go down that particular path. And then I ended up doing a marriage between what I could do here locally and then what I could do distance teams of doctors to talk to each other who had never really talked to each other before. Wow. So yeah, there was a way that I wish there was a nurse navigator or somebody who could navigate me through this process. And then the reality is a lot of that fell on my wife, partially because one way that I dealt with this whole thing was I refused to do any research. I didn't want to get on Google and find out. Right, there was no filter.
Right.
And I myself wanted to be the filter. Like, I wanted to be clear about the information that I was getting. And so when the community would ask, you know, how could I help? I was like, I got these three questions. Go find out what the best answer is and answer those questions for me. And so, for example, my brother, somebody who we don't talk often, but I was like, you want to help? I need these answers to these three questions. So that was really useful. And my wife, you know, the stats, I'm sure, don't look good. And my wife kind of sorted all that and held all that out and filtered that. And so I got really clear about who I wanted to be and how I wanted to show up in this journey. This is a little bit off of your topic of your question, but I think in some way it answered it. In the beginning, it was easy for me to be the victim. Like, and if I could be really honest with you and the world, I was pissed. So I am somebody who for 10 years had tried to not eat sugar. I found out that I was really addicted to wheat, so I had cut out wheat 5 years ago. Ate local, ate organic. A farmer just showed up at my door just moments ago before we started this podcast delivering food from an organic farm just down the road, right? And so, like, who am I to get cancer of the stomach? Like, I've been trying to treat my body well all this time. And I had to just set that aside. Like, I don't know how it is that I am one, and I don't know any of my medical history. I don't know any of my biological history. Excuse me. So I didn't have any of that to go with. And so at first, I was very much a victim of it and a little angry. And I realized I had a few lovely mentors. So thinking about a team, I started reaching out to people who were heroes on this journey. Some of them dead. How they showed up on their journey, it was like, okay, I want more of that. And so I looked back at our communications and such. And then the ones who were alive, I reached out to, and they would come over and we would sit for 3 hours. And one of them especially, he was really beautiful. He had 8 hours of chemo every day for 8 months. He was the only person who survived his trial.
Oh, wow.
And he... Yeah, there was many days he couldn't walk, but his mantra was, I need to walk every day. His wife had to give up custody of their kids in order for her to be at the hospital because she was there so much that she had to have somebody else actually manage the kids. She said it was the hardest day of her life. And so when I sat with them, how they got through that, right, and I realized, they're not the victim. They're actually in this in such a way that cancer is a teacher. And when I turned that switch and I turned it to cancer was a teacher, so that my friend I was just telling you about, he said, I wouldn't wish this experience on anybody, but I also wouldn't take it away from me because I have grown so much on this journey and I understand who I am and who I want to be in the world, and my relationships are so much stronger because of it. And so when I was able to make that switch from being a victim to being a student and allowing cancer to be a teacher, there's a way I showed up much more empowered and was able to ask for what I needed. And when doctors said, we've never done that before, I'd be like, and? Right. And I would just lean in and say, all right, let's look at that. Let's explore that. What's possible here that was not possible before? And so since then, I have coached a few people along on this journey, and I think it's easy to get to your point, Karen, and what you're advocating. I think it's easy to fall into the system, right? The medical system creates efficiency. These people are very valuable. They have a lot of knowledge, and they need things to travel through efficiently. But whoever you are and wherever you are in your journey, you are unique. Right. You might fit somewhere on the bell curve, but who you are is unique. And that's why I didn't want to look at the statistics. You know, I just turned 50. And a lot of people who got stomach cancer are 20 years my senior. So I didn't want to look at people who were smoking and drinking and eating Little Debbie snack cakes every day. And I didn't want to be lumped with them because that's not who I am. And so I'm happy to be talking with you now saying that I've declared myself cancer-free. The doctors can't find anything. There's been multiple scans. And I'm happy to be able to say that. And every day I have pain of some level, you know, navigating what I can eat and can't eat. But getting back to your question, creating a team both socially, like if there's anybody around you who doesn't uplift you, delete. Like give all delete.
Yeah.
Only have people around you that delete. People that uplift you. I began to withdraw. Then I got a really close knit community, and then the doctors who couldn't be really honest. Like most of my doctors actually used camouflaged language around me, and I recognized it. I'm like, I think I'm cool with that. You know, they would say things like, "Well, it's a very aggressive cancer," right? Rather than saying the stats. And once I talked, my wife really likes the numbers and wanted the numbers, and so we pushed on a doctor once, and he says, "You are not the statistics."
Right.
And that was really, really helpful to hear that. So get really clear about who you want to have around you. And then on the social realm, I'll say one other thing that was really beneficial for me is I created a Caring Bridge website. And I have never announced this public, so I'm doing this for the first time. When you set up your Caring Bridge, you can set it up in such a way that it's un-Googleable. Like, people can't Google you and find you. But Caring Bridge, I think it's /RealWise. You can see my 54 journal entries and see my past on that. And one of the things I did very clearly saying to the community, I'm going to post things here. I only want responses back that are uplifting. And I am not putting it on me to respond to you. Like, that was too much work. I'm not on social media, except for LinkedIn a little bit. And I don't know what Facebook is, right? And I didn't want to, that constant weight of trying to respond and to love people back. And one of the things that I found annoying on this journey was people would come up to me and do, "I'm sorry," and just start sobbing. And so on one of my journal entries, I talked about how I had to do the internal work to turn "I am sorry" message into "I love you." It was a way of somebody saying "I love you," but they didn't know how to say or couldn't say "I love you." And so I would just kind of smile instead of being pissed that they were saying I'm sorry. I was just like, "Oh, this is how they can say I love you."
Yeah.
Right? And so I began to filter those people who were potentially pulling me down. I began to filter what they were saying and how I heard it in such a way that they couldn't pull me down. That was a long answer to your question.
Well, you know, I've told you this before, that I, like, honestly love the way that you think. And so in how you navigated this journey, I know we've talked about calling it an odyssey or a journey, and, you know, not, it's not a battle, etc. And just to see how you worked between teams even to get to the result that was satisfactory to you. I talk to a lot of my clients about in the middle of the circle of that interdisciplinary team is you, and that you have to take control. And so I just wanted to, you know, applaud you for how you showed up throughout the process, and even the ebbs and the flows. You know, the videos were very helpful to give insight into how you were thinking about things, and even some of your posts where, you know, there was one about the tree that was rooted really good, and although you know the branches or and the leaves are gone, you know, the root system is strong. And so those were encouraging for me as your friend all the way in Texas, you know, rooting you on, to be able to kind of get a barometer or gauge of kind of how you were handling it, and then, you know, to offer accordingly any words of encouragement or anything like that. And then the Caring Bridge site was definitely helpful. And there's a lot of those kind of apps that are out there that I share with my clients that they can document their journey, or even tracking their symptoms and different things. And, you know, we've shared some different apps with each other as well. So question number two is just kind of the overarching type question, that how have those challenges impacted your life? And I'm kind of asking that in reference to, you know, home life, work life, you know, etc.
Appreciate you asking that. So you alluded to, you know, switching the conversation in my head and in my family from battle to odyssey. And one of my mentors helped me do that, because there was a way that the battle, for me to go into battle, it created a stance that I did not find helpful, you know. Resistance meets resistance. If you push on something, it pushes back. That's how an airplane works, right? It pushes on the air, and the air pushes back, and up it goes. And I didn't want to fight cancer, so I switched it to being a student of cancer. But then I also saw it as an odyssey. It was a really useful word for me, because it shifted my mindset. And then that mindset shifted my relationship with my family and with work in multiple different levels. There is a way that more love showed up in the family, and I realized that connection was more valuable. And on a really practical level, there were some of my clients. So there's a part of my life in which I am a speaker, a trainer, a facilitator, and I do executive coaching. And I, for whatever reason, I decided not to say much about my cancer journey in that realm of my life. And the clients who I had for a long period of time, I told them straight away, because we had, you know, a really strong relationship. But the clients who were coming on board, I didn't say anything. And as I was losing my hair, I would just show up with a hat. And so it was this thing that was always between us. And what happened early on with some clients, they canceled. They could not handle the unpredictability of my life as well as I was handling it. And I would try to be honest with them. I said, okay, but we're looking at this date, here's the plan, and here's a backup plan, I've got this thing going on, and then they would just cancel. And most of those were ones in which I wasn't charging full rate, right? And so I was either doing pro bono work or something, you know, something they were doing, they were up to, that I loved, and I was like, okay, I'll support you and do it at a nominal fee. So that taught me to keep my mouth shut. And so when new clients came on board, you know, I would show up in Texas and Florida and places to do a multiple day retreat and lead them through the material in my book called Ask Powerful Questions, Create Conversations That Matter. And there was this thing between us, because I would never say that this thing, this cancer thing, was there. And the interesting thing, looking back on that, all all of those clients never became repeat clients. That's interesting to note. Because I don't think I got to be my authentic full self in the room. Not that I needed to come in the room and say, I'm losing my stomach next week. But if there was a way that it could have been useful to what we were doing and moving things forward, right? Instead, I was playing the game that I'm really familiar with. If you read the first chapter of my book, there's, I call it the cloak of invisibility. So at a young age, I grew up on the streets and didn't know where I was going to be. So I stole this idea from Harry Potter to speak about it now publicly. I didn't have those words when I was little, but I said I know how to be invisible. So this cloak of invisibility. And so there was this piece of my life in this professional front that I just made invisible. I didn't talk about it. But because I didn't talk about it, it also kind of showed up in really creepy, kind of eerie ways. All of that being said, though, I did get a surprise this week that somebody, a large regional bank, somebody who was in the room just sent me an email saying, hey, you had a scarf and a hat on. You told us at the end that something was going on. How are you doing? Mm-hmm. And that was really nice. But, you know, a year later, they reached out to find out how I was doing. But that was a tricky place to navigate. How much should I say? How much shouldn't I say? And today is the first day with you, Karen, that I'm really allowing this information to be broadcasted broadly. I've kept my mouth shut about it. And the people who are on Caring Bridge are kind of this, you know, circle of knowing. What I have discovered is that Caring Bridge, like my cousin, sent it to somebody who needed to hear the message. So I don't have any idea who this person is. But then she sent me $500.
Oh, wow.
Just because somehow my message was landing for her, and she felt like she wanted to support and such.
Wow.
Which is very inspiring, right? So right now I'm in this process of saying, okay, how public do I go with it? Do I have something that's worth people hearing? Is there a way that my message could be supportive for people who are on the journey? And I think so. And so I guess I'll say to you and your clients, if there is the first person to respond and reach out to me at will@weandme, so my email is will@weand.me. My company's name is called We and Me. You can also reach me at willwise.com, willwise.com. So the first person who reaches out to me and wants me to speak at a some kind of cancer event will get a discount.
Awesome. Thank you for that. I wasn't even going to make the ask, but thank you for that. Well, because I do believe that your message matters. How you showed up through the whole entire process matters. And especially being a guy. You know, we as women, we share a lot, probably overshare at times. But that's how we kind of uplift each other and empathize and help to, you know, encourage each other to keep moving forward. Not so much with men. You would be the second guy on my podcast to share their story. And I've worked with a couple of guys through Rehab Your Life. And it's different as a woman to be supportive to a guy versus another guy supporting a guy. And so I want to encourage you that your message does matter, coupled with the way that you think already. You know, this opens that door even wider to show them how you still worked through it. You still showed up for your family through it. And, you know, we as people, as human beings, like you said yourself, you kind of you shut down for a period of time, and that's understandable. It's okay. But how did you emerge? You emerged on more of a journey to see how this could teach you something and go deeper into learning about yourself. My girlfriends and I have had conversations about how men in general these days are not as equipped as they need to be to have the conversations and to have the communication skills to be able to say what they need. And that's what I heard you say, was that once you kind of took that turn and you made that mental shift, then you were more comfortable with asking for what you needed. So that's awesome. That is awesome. So question number three, what effect has it had on your family and friends? You kind of alluded to that kind of elephant in the room where the relationship broke down on a career side. I experienced it where one of my close girlfriends was like, you don't have cancer. You don't look like you have cancer. And our friendship literally broke down because she was not able to handle me having cancer. And, you know, that's a mouthful to say, because it's like, you're not the one going through it. But how has this all affected your family and your friends and what that dynamic looks like?
Every conversation post-cancer has an elephant. Right? There has this elephant that, you know, you alluded to the whole man thing, right? There's a man relatively close to my physical space who I see often. We've never talked about it. You can't talk about it. And yet he wants to be immensely helpful, right? If I asked him to cut my grass, he'd cut my grass in a second, right? Yeah. He knows what's going on, but he, my wife just told him that he doesn't want to talk about it. And so when people say, how you doing, right? There's this line. This is why Caring Bridge was really, really helpful for me, because I could literally say how I was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the personal conversation, there was always this line where people want to hear you're doing fine.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't. I don't. Like, I'm happy to be here sitting and talking with you, and I'm in a lot of pain right now. And people are afraid of pain.
Yeah.
Right, we allow pain to be a dictator, and we allow it to take over our lives. And part of this journey, so my wife had Cyprus, our first child, in our living room, 40 hours of the most beautiful labor ever. Mm. And I say beautiful because when she was having a contraction, the midwives asked her to raise her finger so that they could tell whether or not she was having a contraction. Because what she was able to do by using a technique called hypnobirthing was she was able to separate out the pain from the suffering. She was in immense pain, but she wasn't suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so she became a really good role model for me on this journey to say, oh, there's pain. I didn't have to create a story along with that pain.
Yes.
That was unempowering, that was in the realm of suffering. And so in those individual conversations with people, there is a way that they also wanted to avoid the pain and me even trying to vocalize what was going on. Like, they wanted to be the cheerleaders. It's like, oh, well. And so I had to decide. I always kind of had to decide, you know, like, how much does this person really want to know? And I sometimes will say, today's a day that kind of sucks. And I'm excited that you're here. Let's talk about why, how I can help you, and da 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 da. Like, I would just try to get it out of the way as quick as possible. in relationship to family, it has had a huge impact on our relationship. Normally, I've made it clear that I want to be there for meals and I want to be there for bedtime. But sometimes by bedtime, my body is done and I'm in so much pain that it's better for me to be alone and try to read to them. And even now that I'm eating a lot of small meals, you know, I just had a birthday recently and the kids were all trying to figure out what could they make for me for my birthday, right? We're all in this lockdown and we're not going to go do something crazy. And I told you what I can eat, so that's not cake.
Right.
And so the kids all decided that they were going to eat their peas and carrots. So it's been work for me to make sure that the relationships are a priority, because I can get really snappy really, really fast. There's a way that when pain shows up, I can take care of what needs to get done, but I'm doing it in a really kind of a bull in the china cabinet kind of efficient way, and I'm not necessarily being very loving while I do it. So one of my challenges is to say yes, you know, and so
in spite of
Fern walked in, so this is a new office for me, and there's two ferns behind me, and my daughter's name is Fern, and she came in with the ukulele, and she said, "Daddy, you play," and I didn't want to play in that moment, right? I was like, I was in the office, and I was working, but the door was open, which the door means you guys can come in, and so she comes in with the ukulele and says, "Your turn." And so I made up a song on the spot about being a fern on the left and fern on the right. And right in front of me is the most beautiful fern. And she goes, "That's beautiful. Sing it again." And so just finding the moment to say yes, instead of letting the pain be a dictator, trying to find ways to let the love be a dictator. The discipline is hard because I believe in a certain amount of discipline as a parent, but it's easy for me to get to raising my voice and yelling rather than saying, "Sorry, son, that's not appropriate." And so I can see that they're on edge. Like, I can get to that kind of, I call my principal voice. Used to be a principal. I get to that principal voice really, really quickly, rather than more conversational. And so I'm like, and so apologizing, saying, I don't feel so great right now. You can't be doing that.
Yeah, it's a process. And, one of the things that you said about, just kind of having pains. I'm in pain right now. I still have like the shoulder tip pain and just overall body aches and pains. I try with the ibuprofen or the Aleve, or just try to figure out, what works. Benadryl ironically helps with like the joint pain, but Benadryl will knock you out and you won't have a productive day. A couple years later, I'm still dealing with that quote unquote new normal. But like you said, still being able to find ways to move forward. One thing that's helped me is practicing mindfulness and kind of, being very mindful of staying present and in the moment, because I've found myself when the kids are talking that I'm somewhere else and having to bring myself back to that moment to literally hear what was said and not just nod in agreement that you can go, go hang out with your friends and do whatever you want to do. And then it's like, wait a minute, what? Is there adult supervision in the house? Because I have older kids, so they're trying to get out and do stuff. But if I wallow in the pain and I don't feel good and I shut down, then I'm not present for them. So practicing mindfulness definitely has helped me in how it's impacted my family having to deal with cancer. So those are the three major questions about the podcast. So now we are rolling into my seven powerful questions. So question number one. Are you a spiritual person?
It's a really interesting question on lots of different levels. I would say that I am a spiritual person. I am not a religious person. I grew up on the streets. And part of that early childhood is I went to a lot of different churches because there was a way that church communities are really generous. And so I would, you know, could get food and other things. One of the things that really shocked me was that in that particular area of the world, that people would go to church, say love thy neighbor, and then flip people off as they were pulling out of the parking lot. Right? It's like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And so when I graduated from college with a degree in forestry, I somehow ended up on the other side of the world in Nepal, which is the only Hindu kingdom in the world, and there is a strong Tibetan Buddhism influence. And there's pockets of Tibetan Buddhists who got kicked out of Tibet, and they've created it. And there was a way that they practiced and lived compassion in a way that I had never seen for a religious group before. And to make a long story short, that sent me on a path that years later, when I went back, I asked if I could sit a 10-day course, and I couldn't, but they told me other places I could, and eventually I took a 10-day course, my first one in Australia. And so I've done, I don't know, 10 or so 10-day courses, maybe more, and I've served as many as I've sat. And I was really, you know, you talked about mindfulness. That gave me a huge amount of strength. Through this whole process. And so that, you know, if you're interested in that, that is Dhamma, DHAMMA.org. And that process, right? So all the teachers who are doing that, everybody who's serving there are doing it because they want to, not because they're getting paid. And maybe there might be one person who's managing the site and who's living there who might get paid a little bit, but everybody's committed. And they meditate for 2 hours a day, and there's a way that has given me an immense amount of strength. And so on this process, you know, people would say, can I pray for you? And I say, yes. Because whether you believe in prayer or not, when people think about you in a positive and generous way, I believe that is beneficial. What name of God you attach to it doesn't matter. I think religions have a lot to offer the world. And when we think and pray positively and uplifting about people, yes, there's a lot of power in that. So I would accept those. And I did a lot of meditation through the process. And every morning before I get out of bed, while I'm still in that quiet state, I scan my body and pay attention to sensations and try to remain equanimous, meaning balanced mind and not reactive. And I think that training has helped me be stronger through this process. And I remember clearly setting in a 10-day course, so 10 days of silence. And I remember somebody getting wheeled in a gurney. And he was dressed in all white. He was laying down. And I don't know his story, and I don't know what was all going on there. But whoever he was, he gave me an immense amount of strength. Because his way of, I assume he was dying. His way of, I'm going to get teary. I don't even know the guy. But the way that he showed up with awareness through the process of death, and not being afraid of death, was somehow that planted a seed inside of me that just, so, you know, when I was in the hospital and my stomach was bloated to, I don't know how to describe this, like far bigger than you could ever imagine it being. And they were still injecting more stuff into me. My bowels haven't started moving yet. Everything was just getting backed up. And I don't swear much, but I swore more in that 48 hours than I have in my entire life. Bombs were dropping out left and right. And that, you know, talking earlier about the care that you needed, like, no, you're not putting more in. We got to get this stuff moving out. Like, really getting clear about all of that. There was a moment in which this man in a white gurney and how he approached death, and other people who've been on a similar journey, and they approach death with such wisdom and grace and love of life, and not running and not being afraid. I'm sure they were afraid, but not letting the fear like dictate how they were gonna show up, and not allowing the fear to make them small. They showed up large, and they showed up bountiful and with love. And so that's a long answer to your spiritual question, but there is a way that there's something bigger than us that I am connected to. And there is something about all of us being interconnected that I acknowledge and I live my life as if that is true. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome answer. So question number two is, how would you answer the question of the week, which is, what does friendship mean to you?
Well, I don't know what I'm about to say. I know it's going to be brand new. Because what occurred to me yesterday, I did a coaching session. So I'm mentoring somebody through a process of she's creating an online workshops for healers. So I'm calling her the healer of healers. And people who are healers are often on a journey where they have to do some internal healing as well as external. And one of the things that she's trying to get this group of people to get really clear about is to speak your truth. And what we got very clear together with in this journey and this last coaching call was that speaking your truth in such a way that you need approval creates all kinds of icky, sticky, nasty stuff that's not very useful for you or anybody else.
Right.
And it creates defensiveness, and it's got a lot of ego in it. And speaking your... So the other side of that is, when we did some peeling some layers and going deeper, we got really clear that speaking your truth rooted in love immensely beneficial for you and for others. And friendship for me is being in a relationship in which people can speak their truth from a place of love, not from a place of neediness, or not from a place of wanting to look good, not from a place of I'm unworthy. And all of that stuff might show up, but the core is from a place of love. Many years ago, I was serving one of those 10-day courses, and in the kitchen, you can talk if you're serving about some things. And one of the things that we were talking about was, he said he had decided a couple years ago to always speak to the truth. I said, who are you and can you be my friend? Because there's so many of us that camouflage and protect. And he said, if you call me and say, you know, why haven't you returned my calls, I'm going to be really forward and honest about what that is. And I cherish that in friendship, right? The ability to create our relationships happen, you know, it happens in our speaking and listening. And so I want to hang out with people who can feel like they can be their authentic self and not play the game of camouflage. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll stop there.
Well, you know, just so the listeners get another earful, I've talked about you over the last couple of years and how we met and how just this friendship has really developed over the years, where even though we're in two different areas of the world, we have a mutual respect for one another in reference to the work that we do and seek to encourage each other to show up at our highest level. And just that authenticity, like you're saying, is something that I truly value in friendship. And when you don't have that, to me, that's not really a true definition of friendship, because if there's that back and forth, you know, tit for tat and all of that, you know, it takes away from the true essence of being my sister's keeper or being my brother's keeper kind of, you know, thought process. And so I just wanted to take this opportunity to tell you once again, because I think I tell you often, how I truly value this friendship that we have developed over time that was just so organically planted that neither one of us even saw coming. And to me, that is that my higher power showing up in that moment to say, hey, this guy is someone that you need to be connected with. He is a part of, you know, like one of my prayers is for the Lord to enlarge my territory. And so he utilizes people to be able to do that. And I think that you are one of those people that for whatever reason, whether it's just developing this one-on-one friendship, or if we are to show up together in a place working together to impact humanity, who knows? But at that moment, at that time in Galveston, Texas, we were supposed to meet each other. And it's just been good stuff ever since. And so you have those what I call predestined type of moments where you still have to act upon, though, to work and develop the friendship. Because there's been times where, especially with me going through my stuff, you going through your stuff, where we may not talk for a month or so, but then we reconnect and how are you doing? Is there anything that I can offer, vice versa? And just it's just as original as the day that we met. And that there makes it just so ooey gooey yummy to me. Because it's we've both showed up from day one. Did I get you a little choked up with all the love?
Maybe it was ooey gooey. I don't know. I love what you were saying.
So, question number. You want to respond?
Yeah, I'd like to say something about that. So, when we met in Galveston, we were at a conference, and I was doing my thing and sending people through different parts of the As Powerful books, and you were doing it. But there was a break in which you came up with an immense amount of curiosity asking questions about what I was doing, and there was a way that our relationship kind of turned into me being a mentor for you on this process. And then Matt, I got to hear your story, you know, the three-time survivor of cancer and yada yada, and my heart went out to you. And if I'm really honest with you, I'm like, that is a crazy story. And one in which I'll never be connected to. Mm. Right? There was a way that my empathy was present, but also limited. Because I didn't understand the journey, right? If you came to me and said, I have a daughter with Down syndrome, then I'd be like, oh, I know that story. Or that I've got, you know, whatever, I got these other pieces of my life. And I've had those felt experiences, and so... yours was so phenomenal. When I came home and told my wife about it, I was like, I can't even imagine that. But I saw myself very distant from it. But the ironic piece is, your gift to me was you were the first, I believe, that I reached out to outside of my inner circle. Mm. And I remember driving home along this road that I drive on, and I called you and said, I've got something to tell you. And suddenly your story had been planted as a seed within me. Even if I would have called you and you wouldn't have picked up, but I, just the fact that I had met with you and heard your story, it in itself was a strength to me. Mm. It did happen to be that you picked up, and I got all giggly that you picked up, and I said, well, I've got something to tell you. And you were immensely present, and you didn't get caught at, you know, all caught up in the drama of it. You're like, okay, what's step one? And you, right, and we were very matter of fact, and like, you've been on this path. And so that was, you know, an added benefit. And so I guess one thing to say to our listeners is, where is it that you can find that strength? You know, what books might you need to read? What podcasts might you need to listen to? Who are the people that you could reach out to and ask? Can they be a mentor? Can they encourage you in some kind of way? Because cancer is, at least for me, is a journey that you feel like you're on alone.
Yes.
And one of the hospitals that I was doing some stuff at had a Hope Lodge in which you can stay for free, and I stayed there and ended up doing some coaching sessions with some of the people that worked there and such. But even those who were there, and there was suddenly this instant community, there was still this feeling of, well, we're doing this thing alone. And you're not.
Right.
It's a story that you're telling yourself that is not very powerful. It's not very helpful. And so find places, find people that have been on the journey, and tap into them in a way that you are comfortable with.
Awesome.
Thank you for being that for me, Karen.
You are welcome. I found it, and I don't know if I've ever told you this. We got a lot of firsts on today's podcast. I don't know if I watched the... Okay, I watched this movie called The Shack right before I met you. And I think that's the sequence of events, because I remember telling you that you reminded me of the character in the movie that played Jesus. And being that night after having met you in the hotel, I really just reflected on how I believe you showed up for me at the conference, and that I was supposed to meet you, because what you caused was a shift in my whole thinking process. The way that you can ask a powerful question to be able to get through all of the fluff and get directly to what you needed from the person. Whether it was through a series of questions or not, it helped to shift my perspective on my walk that I am currently on the other side of cancer. And I recall us having a conversation where you were like, you know, how much time do you spend watching TV or something of that nature? And I was like, oh, I got my favorite shows and my this and my that. And you are the one who turned me on to listening to podcasts. Therefore, I now have a podcast. And so it's just funny how that moment in time has birthed so much good stuff. That to me, you know, it was predestined where I feel like you showed up for me in that moment, which prepared me to be able to show up for you in your moment. Just a real full circle kind of thing. So that's awesome.
Yeah, there's these words that have been showing up in my life in the last 48 hours about life fully expressed. And there was a way, and I don't remember that moment with the TV example, but I could see me saying something about that. Right, and when I sit down to watch TV, I'm not living my life fully expressed. Right, I'm just becoming a sponge. But when I listen to something that really empowers me and gets me thinking, there's a way that now I'm engaged, right? I'm taking that information and I'm engaging with it. And what I loved about you straight away is I was at my booth and there was this quiet moment and you pulled up, I invited you to pull up a chair. You pulled up a chair in such a way like...
like I'm about to soak it all in.
Yeah, like... game on. I'm going to watch every nuance that's going to happen here. And I'm like, who is this woman? And I relished in it because it's like, I believe the teacher teaches what they most need to learn. Mm. It's one of my philosophies. And so, you know, I am not naturally a great question asker. I wrote this book called Ask Powerful Questions. It's got this piece about connection in it. I'm really good at hiding, right? Not connecting. And so there's been this long process of me learning how to do it and its use. And when you showed up and willing to like, okay, we've only got 20 minutes before the next breakout session. You're like, what can I suck up in this 20 minutes? How can I engage with the world? And you were expressing yourself fully expressed. You were life fully expressing itself. So it was relatively easy to reach out to you and say, okay, I'm beginning to go on this. I don't know what I said at that time, but the way I would say it now if I was to call you up, I'm beginning to go on this odyssey that you have walked on. And I would love to, you know, I would love for you now to be my mentor as I move forward. And I think because we changed roles, we became partners and living our life fully expressed. Like, yeah, let's do that for each other more often.
Yeah, definitely. So question number three, you kind of touched on it a little bit. What are you reading, watching, or consuming these days?
So, pre-cancer, I would have up to 12 books next to my bed, mostly self-help books. One that I never finished because it had such a profound effect on me was Brené Brown's Daring Greatly. And, you know, we got into this whole realm of shame, and I'm like, I don't experience shame. Oh my gosh, I do experience shame. What's that mean? And yeah. I would try to duck and hide. Yeah. And so what happened in this last year is I got really clear about what could come into my brain. And I kind of started shopping around for different stuff, and so I don't read novels, for example. But when you're in a lot of pain, having a place to escape is kind of lovely.
Right.
So I picked up a few of those, and I might have read one or two, and I can't remember what they were, but having a place to escape a little bit was useful occasionally. The piece that came to me from like seven different sources that was really empowering and continues to be so is Dr. Joe Dispenza. I'm not saying his name quite right. And he's got this Going from Ordinary to Extraordinary. He's got a lot of material out there and a lot of audio. And so, and a lot of meditations. And so his work has been useful. And I was getting it from so many different sources. I'm like, all right, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, a local healer here said, had an all-women's group. And some kind of weird exchange, she invited, she thought Heather was interested in going. And she's like, oh, I'm super excited for Heather to go. And what ended up happening in that is Heather didn't want to go. There was a request for, did I want to go? And I was like, yeah, I think I do. And so the all-women's group said, all right, can we have them? We'll come. And now there's like three of us men involved in the group. So his work was really useful, and I would encourage that. Some of the Buddhist teachers was really useful for me because of, you know, acknowledging the reality as it is. One book that I did not read during this process, but that was really useful for me was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And having that is kind of a guidepost. And one of the strongest points, in my own words, about that book is that you don't get to choose what happens to you necessarily. You don't get to choose the circumstance, but your final freedom, your last freedom, the one that people cannot take away, is you get to choose how you're going to respond.
Yes.
And that was immensely useful. And he was talking about it in the concentration camps. And I was like, those stories gave me a lot of strength through this process. There's an On Being podcast that I love. So there's been times when I've been in the hospital or just need somebody's voice in my head. And Kristen Tippett, I love her voice, and I love who she interviews and how she interviews. And so I sometimes would put those on repeat, just not to get another character in there, but just continue to listen to those. Those are three or four that jump out.
Okay. Question number four, what have you learned about yourself while going through your challenges?
What have I learned about myself? I don't think I've had anybody ask me this question, which is really interesting, thinking about that I turned cancer into a teacher. And I have this sign behind me here that says, what is one thing that life is teaching you right now? And it, to me, it's one of the most profound questions. I got a version of it from a master tracker, Tom Brown, where, you know, he was trying to teach awareness. And I believe awareness combined with equanimity is a really, really powerful tool. So constantly asking, what is this moment teaching me? But when you just asked it right now, there's something that shifted inside of myself, and that is I'm as big or as small as I declare myself to be. And oftentimes I choose small. And so and when I say big, I don't mean like ego big. I mean like
showing up,
full of life, showing up, right?
Yeah. Well,
one of my mentors says, "Don't be a log and don't be a hog." Right, a log just sitting there and a hog hogging up the space, but being in a place of contribution. So one of the things that got clear, I did skim through my journal posts like 10 minutes before this call, and I saw that the fifth post was a video of me. I didn't watch the video, but I saw the title of it. It reminded me that one of the things that became very clear to me on this journey is there's this thing that we call normal, and we schedule our lives in such a way that we make everything normal, right? And we create processes and routines to create a certain kind of efficiency. There was one time in my life where I thought I was going to become an efficiency expert and I was going to help organizations be more efficient. Looking back on that right now, it makes me giggle a little bit, because I think when we are constantly striving for efficiency, we give up. It's a very expensive thing, because we give up vibrancy. And vibrancy, compared to normalcy, vibrancy is the place where we show up life fully expressed, where we are most alive, where the blooming of a flower. My boy and I were out on this property and we were planting some trees. Well, we planted one tree and I found an oak growing up in the grass. The grass is too long. I haven't cut it. And so somehow the oak, you know, popped its head up. I'm like, oh, wow. And so we tried to protect the oak. But my boy asked me, what is this flower? And I had no idea what it is. It was one that's growing in the grass, and it's got little pink and purple lines. And when we pulled it up and looked at it closely, it's immensely beautiful. This little tiny thing that none of us ever see, that I would just step on. But that is the place where we're alive, where we're seeing beauty and seeing each other and allowing each other to show up. And so much of our work is about roll call and accountability in such a way that we're in this place of normal, right? And routines. We're not in this place of being alive. And so the thing I learned about myself is I've done a lot of work to create a lot of normal in my life. And how boring does that seem now that I've gone and danced with the Grim Reaper and realized that we all have a limited amount of time left on the planet. So what does it look like when I become most alive and invite others to be most alive and celebrate life rather than expecting? That's it. There's something right there. There is something new for me right now. There's a way that in the realm of normal, we're expecting things to go a particular way. And how relevant is that to what's going on today? And yet we all have an opportunity in each moment to make choices that bring delight in the world. And one way that we bring delight in the world is making a contribution to others. You ever hang out with people who volunteer? Like, that's where people are most alive. They're like just being their generous selves, and those are the people you want to hang out with. Right? It's because they're making a contribution and they're bringing joy into the world.
Good.
Another long answer.
I love it though, because it reminds me of a time where I literally jumped on a plane, went to Illinois, spent some time with a friend in Chicago, went back home to Peoria. But in that moment, because of where my headspace was of just finding the joy in everything, I enjoyed the plane ride. I saw the flowers bloom. I saw a random bird. Oh, that's a cardinal. It's the bird of Illinois. And I loved on and hugged on everybody that I could during that visit. And so I know exactly what you mean by that vibrancy and just flowing with that. But I also see how you said it really is a choice to how you want to show up. Are you going to show up big in that moment, or are you going to show up small? And there's no right or wrong with that, because in the moments when I need to kind of go back inside and just do some personal self-care, I'm choosing to show up small in my personal space in that moment, and that's okay. Or for my birthday, what I did was I reorganized my bedroom, and I have a record player with my record station, and I have some wine and some coffee. I got a coffee bar, so then I can choose to enclose myself in my room and play small, or that could be big because I'm dancing and I'm singing and I'm enjoying myself in the moment. So really the key thing that I got out of what you said was that we have that choice, and whether we choose small or big in that moment, how we show up is what matters, how we choose it to be, depending on who we're around or if we're by ourselves. We can still be big or small, no matter the environment. That's what I got.
Yes, and I think you just talked yourself into a circle that I want to make really clear.
I felt like it went in a circle too, but I understood what I meant.
No, what you said was perfect, and I just want to, if I could draw a highlighter, you could show up small and retreat. You know, so I'm an introvert who has an extroverted job, and so I could retreat in such a way that I am small, but I could also retreat and go be by myself in such a way that I am big.
Yes.
And I think what I mean by big in that particular case is I am nurturing.
Yes.
Right? I am nurturing myself rather than there's a way that I could show up small when I'm spending that time alone, in which I'm putting Band-Aid on the wounds, right? I'm taking care of I wish I wouldn't have said that, or my energy got totally zapped today because I had too many meetings, right? So there's a way I can show up small and retreat. There's also a way that I can go, all right, so now this is my 3-hour bath time.
Exactly.
I'm rocking out with a podcast and I don't know, whatever it is that it nurtures you, right? To take a walk in the woods, not as balm on the wounds necessarily, although there's times when that is needed, but as a way to plug in to all that is.
Yes.
And allow that to recharge you and allow that to nurture you. And that would be, in the distinction that I am making, that would be showing up big, even though you're all by yourself.
Yes. You got it. You got it. So, question number 5. What kind of supports did you receive from family and friends throughout your challenges? And the reason I ask this question is so people can identify tangible ways that they can also support others.
Thanks for the intent. Now ask me the question again.
What kinds of supports did you receive from family and friends throughout your challenges?
I can't imagine what people, you know, one of the things, I did this homeless program a long time, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and one of the women that showed up, she was Black in a predominantly white town, and it was a role play, and she showed up with a blanket, she got cardboard boxes, like she was way into it. But during the debrief, she's like, no, this is real. I had to do this recently with my kids. I experienced homeless and we slept out of the car. And I say all of that because she's a single mom, right? And I can't imagine what people have to go through to do this without a partner. And so I say that this was more difficult for my wife than it was for me, and she would disagree with me. And I say it's still more difficult for her than it. She can't go to the kitchen and bring me something to eat, right? It's constantly changing what I can and cannot eat. She can't keep up with it. I can't keep up with it. I think this was really difficult and challenging for her. And then she became the front line of answering all the questions and dealing with all of that as I, you know, retreated into this quiet, like, I gotta find my zen.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we did that brought an immense amount of joy to me and to the world, I believe, is before I lost my stomach, I think I had already started chemo at this point, so food was already becoming an issue. We invited the community to a potluck. So where I'm at in the country, it's very central Pennsylvania. Potlucks are so common. But we said, this potluck is, what's your last meal? What would be your last meal? This is going to be, you know, one of my last meals for my stomach. I'm going to go off and get my stomach taken out next week or what have you. And the amount of people that showed up and the food, that was the best potluck I had ever been at, right? The food was so phenomenal. So much so that I thought about having, you know, now I'm recovered potluck, but call it a hors d'oeuvre potluck.
Awesome.
And so everything that you would bring would be small hors d'oeuvre, and you would just walk around because I can't eat that much at a time.
But I thought, love it.
How interesting would that be that you, at some time during the night or the meal, that you would just get up when you feel so called to grab yours, to walk around with a little napkin and pass it out. The Caring Bridge was really useful. The Hope Lodge was useful. Allowing people to drive me back and forth was useful. My parents came, and when I was in the hospital for like a 10-day stretch, they came and took care of the kids. My wife wasn't really interested in meal trains, but some of that happened, which was lovely and easy. And people brought meals when my mom was here with the kids. And here's the other one that is really, will probably annoy your listeners. And it annoys me on some level. Is when somebody offered something, I said yes. Mm. Almost every single time, I try to figure out a way to say yes. And even if it was something I didn't want, I would see if there was a way that I could tweak it so it would benefit the community or somebody. And I got this philosophy from, I would love if this guy would listen to this, his nickname, and I think he goes by Crutches, and he's a street performer in Philadelphia, and he's on crutches. He has legs, but they don't work as legs should from the waist down. But he's probably one of the best skateboarders around, right?
Oh, wow.
And so, but he does this on crutches.
Wow.
And he was on a national Visa commercial for their Flow campaign. But one of the things he does, apparently, is he gets on a bus. People get on the bus, and he is on the sidewalk, and he rides on the sidewalk. He's got music in his ears, and people on the bus hear the same music.
Oh.
And so he rides along on the city, but creates these moments in which the bus stops, and he creates amazing street performer.
Yeah.
One of the things that he shared with me was that when he would pretend to fall, on the steps of the courtyard or the courthouse, for example. These great big long steps about halfway down. He was bald, put crutches every which way, his legs every which way, so he'd look like a star. And somebody would come and help. And however they helped, he would match. So if they grabbed his elbow, he would grab their elbow. Mm. And what he realized in this process was that people need to help. That they want to make a contribution. So I found myself saying two things. I don't know how to accept your help. Or I would find myself saying yes. And as a man, it's really easy to say, no, 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 we got it.
Yeah.
But that's not it. I don't think that is the place where community can show up. So that's when I started saying, yes, I have these three questions. Can you go answer them? I need somebody to cut the grass. I need... and try to give things that were particular, but if people, you know, showed up with food, I'd say yes, and then I would accept it and try to figure out, if I couldn't eat it, figure out who could and where it could go and where it would be useful. Just saying yes as much as I possibly can, as long as it was truly beneficial and a place from love, I would just keep saying yes. And it would bring a smile to my face and bring a smile to their face. Yeah.
Okay, we're down to the last two. We've been on a little longer than I wanted for you, because I know we both kind of got these just aches and pains.
Well, question. Thank you for sticking along, listeners. I'm sorry for my long ramblings, but what else you got?
Question number six. Do you have words of wisdom for someone who may be going through something similar?
Be clear about who you want to be in this process and show up fully that, right? If you want to be love in all your interactions, even the nurse who's about to poke you and piss you off, like, love them.
Yeah.
My relationship with my caregivers, like, it's a factory, right? It can easily turn into a factory efficiency. And I worked really hard to say, okay, I'm going to connect. I'm going to work hard to connect. And what was possible because I made that happen was my wife was more able to be fully present. Post-surgery, within, you know, my stomach's out of my body, and within, I think, 24 or 48, I can't remember the time frame, but it was unheard of. I walked out of the hospital just to walk on the ground because I wanted to be outside.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have done that if I didn't have a relationship with those nurses.
Yeah.
Right? They wouldn't have made space for that. So, you know, who do you want to be? And be that fully and be engaging and loving. And even when you're in pain, you know, to say, I'm in pain and I am so happy you're here. So gratitude. There was one time I was on the curb at my house with surgery, and things were so bad. I thought I was going to die. It was ugly. And the only thing that got me out was gratitude. And I thought, you know, I do have a house I can walk into, and I have a bed that I can get in. And the gratitude led to a place of generosity. And then the generosity led to more gratitude. And then as that cycle from gratitude to generosity started cycling around, joy would start showing up. And it was the joy that made it so death wasn't so close. Yeah.
Awesome. And last and final question, number seven. What are your hopes for the future? What's next for you?
So I guess I said one of those what's next is to talk about this more publicly in a way that I never have before. And I'm putting together, probably this week or next, I'm putting together an online community of people who want to make a difference in the world and learn. And not learn, but necessarily magnify what they are capable of doing. So what's next for me is the lever got longer. Mm. What I mean by that is I want to leverage more of what my gifts might be by sharing those with others so that their gifts can get magnified and they can do what's required for them to make a difference in the world.
Awesome.
Thank you.
So, where can my audience connect with you? Kind of, what are your social media handles?
So, being a social media Luddite, is that the right word? I'm not sure what the Luddite is. So, willwise.com, that's my name, willwise.com, that is truly my name. I didn't make it up. Lot to live up to. I'm on LinkedIn, so people can find me there, again, at Will Wise. I don't know what Twitter and Facebook, so you can't reach me there. If you're interested in my organization, We and Me, that's We, W-E-A-N-D, M-E, so We and dot Me. You can reach me there. Yeah. And then if you want to send me an email, will@weand.me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I know that it is at a premium, and I just truly value our friendship, and I really look forward to seeing what comes of this new found desire, if you will, to delve into seeing how you can use this for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Hey ladies, Father's Day is right around the corner. If you're looking for custom ideas or just want to pick up a quick ready-made basket, connect with Danielle Smith, a Mary Kay beauty consultant. She is offering 20% off all men's items, and she has Father's Day baskets ranging from $25 and up. Click on the link in the show notes to go to her website at www.marykay.com/Danielle Smith. And there, so you have it. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Rehab Your Life podcast. Be sure to like, comment, and share this episode with your friends. Please subscribe to my podcast so that you can get the latest episodes. Also, check me out on Facebook and Instagram at Rehab Your Life in the number 2. I hope that you have a blessed week. Goodbye for now.